Welcome to this Business of Music and Poetry podcast, where the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amade, host of World Poetry Open Mic and The Michael Amade Show, publisher of World Poetry Magazine, musician, poet, and author of more books than I should mention. My collaborator and co-conspirator in this project is none other than Clifford Brooks. Cliff is the author of Athena Departs and The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics. He's the founder of the Southern Collective Experience and is a creative force behind the Blue Mountain Review. Our guest today is Michael Romke. Bram Stoker Award-nominated author Michael Romke writes smart, character-driven horror. His first and much-imitated vampire-themed novel, I, Vampire, is a cult classic. His series continued with The Vampire Papers, The Vampire Princess, The Vampire Virus, Vampire Hunter, The London Vampire Panic, and Telluride Blood. His other works include Fear's Point, The Vampire's Violin, and American Gothic. Now, the bio on his website reads, "I live on the banks of the mighty Mississippi in the USA heartland, Iowa, to be specific. My musical interests are what might be called, for lack of a better label, Americana. A variety of fiddle tunes, bluegrass, folk, blues, country blues, Irish, Scottish, Celtic, the bigger category, punk, classical, country. Basically, music as people play it, sitting in their kitchens or on the front porch with a cup of coffee or a glass of rye nearby." You can see he has such a varied personality and so many great interests. We're really looking forward to this. This is Cliff Brooks' interview with author and musician Michael Romke.
Welcome. It's wonderful to share this time with y'all this evening on another episode of This Business of Music and Poetry. And now we sit and share wisdom, life stories, and a few funny moments with one of my favorite novelists and musicians, Michael Romke. Michael, how are you doing, boss?
I'm just peachy. How are you?
I am fine and dandy like sour candy. I cannot complain, man. The way that I found your career was, I think it was around 95, 96, with your first, the first novel that I wrote of yours, I, Vampire. What drew me in the most, and I know I bored with you with this ad nauseum about my admiration of it, is that you have this unique ability to take a trope like the vampire story, the legend, and make it not only your own, but the literary, the classical components that make poetry work, you bring into the world of fiction and in the prose world. I have been dying for like the last, you know, nearly 20 years to ask you, when you sat down to write that book, which turned into a series, how did you get all those components to come together and gel so well?
Well, it's a long and complicated story. To begin with, I'm an English major. So that's kind of where all of the, you know, knowing about Milton and T.S. Eliot and all that jazz comes in, because I just had it beat into me. But I really love it. And that's all really kind of the background music to my brainwaves anyway, and kind of still is, actually, all these years later. I'm also was a journalist. I'm retired now, but I was a journalist by trade. And so everything had to make sense. And so I remember reading Interview with a Vampire by Anne Rice. And this whole explanation that vampires kind of just were, or went back to Egypt, or whatever, however that all worked, that whole supernatural explanation didn't really work for me. And it had to have some kind of grounding in fact. And so the protagonist that I started out with in that book was a coke-addled lawyer from Chicago. And I mean, I thought that was something that existed that I knew about from various different angles. Mm-hmm. And but I wasn't satisfied with the notion that vampires were just supernatural creatures. I didn't think that, I mean, today I would, I have much more belief in the supernatural than I did back in the early 1980s, and being a newspaper guy, being a reporter, and having to be able to back things up with facts and logic and rationale and some sort of explanation for what was going on. So I guess my first book, so that was actually my second book. My first book was a book called Fierce Point, which was, I think, really in a lot of ways, nobody's ever read it, but it's, I think maybe even a better, I think it's a better book, really. And it's all, it's basically an allegory of, so it's a book about the supernatural, but it's basically an allegory of small town paranoia. My wife and I, my late wife and I, were living in a little farming town in Iowa, and I was in a band, and we lived out on this farm because basically I worked in the city, but like we live like 45 miles outside of town on this farm, this little farming community with all these like kind of hippie Neil Young type musicians who were also farmers or whatever. And then like in the course of all this, they were all becoming doctors and lawyers and going on and being something besides just farmers, because if you, you know, if you had a brain, that was like, not that you don't have to be smart to be a farmer, but we're all young and kind of trying to figure out where we're going in life. Right. And we all lived in this outside of this little town. And so a lot of the guys who lived there were born in the town and went to school, you know, went through grade school and high school in this town. And I go into the, there was one grocery store in town called Jeff's Market, and I'd go in there and I'd see my buddies who I was like up literally all night long, all weekend long, partying and playing music. And they'd be talking animatedly, and I'd walk in and they'd fall into silence because the stranger had walked in. And I was only the stranger in the context of this weird insular little town where all these people and their parents and their grandparents and their grandfathers going back to the 1870s and 1880s had grown up. And it just made me paranoid as hell. So my first book was, it was about witches. And it, but it was an allegory of small town paranoia. So the allegory is kind of the English major thing getting into the horror thing. And to go even backwards farther from that, where that got started is for a while out of college, I went to the University of Iowa. I got a job in the newspaper business because I needed to make money.
Right.
And I wanted to write fiction, right? I thought, I want to write some books, but I thought, well, God, I'm like, you know, 22, 23. I don't know enough to write fiction. Mm-hmm. So I worked at a newspaper, and my stepfather was actually the editor of the National Enquirer. And so he was doing that. And so I was going to college, and I was working at a small daily newspaper in actually in Davenport, Iowa. And he decided that he was going to make a ton of money. So he quit his job and he got together with a bunch of venture capitalists, and they started a book company called Rhapsody Romances. And their concept, like, so this is like back in the early 80s, and romance novels are big business back then. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of hard, like, even in my, you know, I mean, I don't think of myself as being that old, but it's like, there's been so much technological disruption in the last 30 or 40 years. So 40 years ago, I mean, there were three TV channels that you could watch. And if you were a woman, a romance novel, I mean, there wasn't Netflix, there wasn't HBO, there wasn't, you know, any of that. So, you know, your escape was romance novels. So he started a company called Rhapsody Romances. And what their shtick was is they were going to, they had a big contract with a company called Texas Roto-Gravure in Texas, and they printed the National Enquirer. So they had these really high quality color presses. So what they were going to do is they were going to buy romance novels, and they were in South Florida, which is where they did, where they still do all of this catalog work. You know, so there are all these models, there are New York modeling agencies. There's all this kind of showbiz stuff going on in Palm Beach County that, you know, people aren't really even aware that it's happening, but it's kind of like Southern California, only it's on the East Coast.
Right.
And so what he was going to do is he was going to lease Lear jets and yachts and mansions on Palm Beach and hire either actresses or catalog models and cast them in the role of the characters who were in the romance novels and go out and take pictures to illustrate the books.
Right.
And so he ended up hiring me and my late wife, Carol, to move down and be editors for these romance novels. So we did that for a couple of years. And we could have been rich doing that. When they went to New York and launched those products. So you have to imagine like a tabloid size novel. And on the cover of it is this beautiful girl kissing this incredibly handsome guy in front of a Learjet. Mm-hmm. And the book is called, one of them was Dreamweaver. And it was about this woman who was a fiber artist who weaved her dreams into these fabulous fiber art. And she had a patron who was a millionaire who blah, 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 blah. And so we did that for a couple of years. And that actually ended up being such a success when they launched it. There was a big fight to take over the company, mm-hmm. and all of these publishers fighting with it to take over control. Because this was just like a small thing run by, they spent quite a bit, like big money in venture capital back in the days. It was like a couple of million bucks. And people right. were like fighting. It was going to be such a big deal fighting over who took it over. And it ended up just going down in flames
yep.
over the backstabbing and the infighting in the publishing industry. It was just such a horrible thing to experience mm-hmm. that, because we all thought we were going to be like, you know, we're in on the ground floor of what was going to be sort of this publishing Netflix or something. Mm-hmm. And it just imploded. It was terrible. And so suddenly I went from making all this money and having this nice place to live in Palm Beach County to being like unemployed. So my wife and I, we did what anybody would do in that situation. We bought a couple of cases of wine and got some tents and went camping in the Keys. And we took our, what would have been the laptops of our time, our Royal typewriters, down to the Keys. And we started working on our novels, because we were going to both write novels. And my wife was going to write, who was a really gifted, gifted, gifted editor, was going to write a romance novel. Mm-hmm. And she didn't ever finish it. You know, and it was really, you know, a bunch of people read it, agents read it, thought it was really good, but she could never get it done. But so I started writing horror fiction because I wanted to get a book published, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, so it's like, what are the, you know, so I thought, well, I can write a story about coming of age in the Vietnam. No, that's not going to work. I can write a novel about, you know, South Florida drugs. I mean, that would have been probably a good topic. And, you know, some people like Less Than Zero actually were able to do something out of that whole culture. But I decided to write I knew people who were agents and I talked to them and they said, well, don't write a Western. Westerns are dead ducks. No Westerns, no Westerns. And I ended up, you know, settling on I didn't really think I had it in me to write like a detective story or a mystery or whatever, but I thought everybody knows what getting the shit scared out of you is. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I knew that. And I was always into that. I remember like when the company was failing, we went out to this party on this island and it was quite debauched. And I had a copy of the new out The Shining, Stephen King, The Shining. And I was sitting on the beach reading The Shining, you know, and everybody else was whooping it up. And I was reading this novel. I couldn't put it down. And so I thought, well, this I get, right? Getting scared, I get. And from my English background, I guess like one of the things that really I totally to this day believe in is I can remember one of the books we read, one of the important books we read when I was as an upperclassman in Iowa was Anatomy of Criticism by Northrop Frye, mm-hmm. which was all about Jungian archetypes in fiction, mm-hmm. you know? And I thought, I mean, I still, to this day, like last week I was listening to some, what's that guy's name? Jordan Peterson talking about
that's my Jung. Boy.
Oh, he's the man. You know, mm-hmm. all of these, you know, and the thing about a horror novel is it's good versus evil, light versus dark, you know? And it's about temptation, right? You know, it's all of the things that, I mean, my God, everybody understands this stuff, you know? So like, if you were to write a book about, I don't know, pick anything, you know, like sort of like in my life, the end of the newspaper business, right? Sort of the whole disintegration of print publishing. I mean, I totally live that. And I've been out of it 3 or 4 years now, and I still like have elaborate, vivid nightmares about the collapse of that business and the collapse of my last newspaper and all of that. But it's like, that doesn't resonate with people, right? I mean, it's like, it's what are those archetypal things, you know, that whether you're writing poetry or you're writing fiction or you're writing music, I mean, all of these things weave together. And so I wrote this book. So I wanted to write this book, and I don't know why I got started on witches. I guess I thought that was kind of and that turned out literally not to be a thing. So I sold this book, and after I sold it, my editor and my agent told me, witches, I think witches were a thing for a while, but they're dead. And the only thing that's worse than witches are werewolves. Do not write a book about werewolves.
Amen. Amen. Preach it. Go ahead. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so the company failed. We went to the Keys. We took our Royal typewriters. We started writing. My wife ran out of gas. I didn't. I kept working on mine. But we came back and, this is the part that I mentioned that you can feel free to cut out of the story. So we came back to Palm Beach Gardens, and a friend of mine who was a plasterer said, you're out of work. Do you want to help me come out? I'm plastering the outside of this new mansion, and we're putting like these field stones on this chimney. So he's going to put plaster on it and then put these like stones in this. Yeah. And do you want to come out and help me? So I'm like, sure, why not, you know? So I did that for a week or two. And he said, okay, well, the job's done. Do you want money? Or would you like, or I could pay you in cocaine. And I said, well, I want to be mature about this, of course. I'll take the cocaine. So, because I was trying to write this novel, so I took the cocaine. And so I went back, and I don't think I told my wife any of this. And so, you know, every day it was time to write for a month or two. So I'd go into the office and close the door. I would inspire myself. And I'd sit down and I thought, this has got to work, right? I mean, this has got to work. So I'm like, this is going to, I'm going to have to do some revision on this, you know? I mean, but just the raw energy driving this story, you know, I go like this, you know, and I did this for, I don't know, a while, weeks, you know, and so then I got a job at a newspaper in the Midwest, so we moved back, so I had this stack of this, I can still see this paper, it was old, what was it called? Newsprint or something, you get this really cheap paper that was sort of like after a year or two, it'd start to fall apart. It was like very high wood pulp. It was very brown. And it was really cheap, right? So I had a gigantic stack of this paper from this novel that I wrote. It was like 400 pages. So I get back to the Midwest. I'm like, okay, well, it's time to edit this baby. Now I'm back in the real world. I've got the paycheck coming in. I've had a time for this story to cool off. So I get it out and I'm get my pen out and it was a complete waste of time. I didn't use, I don't think I used one word. It was like, what had I done? You know, what had I done? So I started over and the first computers were coming out. And I was talking to my friend John Beidler at the office, and he had one of the first. So this would have been in 1984, around 1984. He had one of the first Macintoshes, Apple Macintoshes. And I said, I'm not getting one of those. He's like, well, you're working on a book, right? And I'm like, yeah. Hemingway didn't have a computer. And he said, this guy was like really logical. He said, he would have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bought a Macintosh. And so I worked on the first one and finished it. And, used some of my contacts from my romance career. And the agent that I thought who was going to represent me had retired, but she said, I've turned all my clients over to this other guy. So I, sent him a chapter and a self-addressed stamp postcard.
I remember those days.
You want to read more of this? And he did. And he liked it. It was really pretty good. If I do say so myself, in a kind of a sophomore effort way. So I sent it to him and he sold it to Fawcett, which is a Random House imprint, and for not very much money, but it seemed like a lot then. And so it came out, and God, I can remember that like it was yesterday. It was so weird. The year that got published, I ran my first marathon. My wife was in the, I was finishing it. My wife was in the hospital having our first son, and I was shipping off the final draft, 1984. And it came out, and it took like a year or so to come out. And it was like in these end caps at the grocery store in the Midwest. You used to go into the supermarket,
uh-huh.
and there'd be these end caps, mm-hmm. and there'd be these new novels. And my late wife went in there, and there was my book in the grocery store. It was like, where's my Maserati? This is so cool. I'm moving to Venice now. And well, that didn't happen. And so it didn't sell that well. But I was already thinking about another book, and I was thinking about a book about vampires. And I had the idea. So that was just luck. That was just luck. Vampires were a good topic at the time. It got to a point where I finished out kind of my series, Vampires Had Become Passé. I don't think vampires ever go away because they're such sexual creatures, really. I mean, vampires are all about sex. But I wanted to write a book about vampires. I wanted it to make some kind of sense, right? Mm-hmm. Not like, well, they're vampires, and then this happens. I mean, it had to have some sort of logical explanation. And that was still kind of in the AIDS day, which was, I don't want to be at all cavalier about. And my editors and publishers were all very, kind of a little squeamish about that. But,
right.
Just the notion that there was some kind of thing that you could, some sort of virus that you could transmit that would mess around with your DNA. And that was the explanation. It wasn't like the devil, or he was born on Christmas, so he's a vampire, or some stupid thing that made no sense. Mm-hmm.
Right.
But then I thought, okay, so if you're a vampire and you basically live for like a really long time, that brings up all kinds of really like interesting angles. So like, if you can live forever, what are you going to spend your time doing? Going to Raiders football games, playing. I mean, there weren't video games then, but playing video games.
Right.
I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to get, I figured you'd get, if you really had time for your personality to really mature, you'd get kind of interested in art, right? Mm-hmm. And you'd get interested in poetry. Or you might get interested in mathematics or astronomy, God knows what, the things that make culture. So the fact that you were a vampire was kind of like that, like would have as much influence as the fact that you're white or black or Catholic or Protestant or whatever. These would sort of be irrelevant things. You would home in on what was really important. But at the same time, the really essential elements of your character would over time out. And I think, you know, there's a saying about the older we get, the more we become who we really, really, really are, which is kind of a scary prospect, you know, because, I mean, like a lot of people, I probably feel like I'm kind of a semi-failed person with a lot of, you know, compromises in my past. And, yeah, I mean, you know, if you're honest with yourself, you know, we're all sinners, right? But, you know, but if you live for hundreds of years, you know, and you had like the kind of ability to like, if you needed money, you could kind of just like study how the stock market went or crypto went or whatever. And like, and, you know, you had the ability to see, you know, kind of what the patterns were. So money was never going to be a problem and time wasn't going to be a problem, you know? And so like, if you're interested if you're interested in music, you'd become a really, you know, good musician. But if you were bad, over time, you would become more and more and more morally compromised, or you'd become, you know, a little bit better, you know, every day, every year, every century or whatever. So I thought that that was just an interesting proposition. And I thought the thing that I like about it is that it, none of it was like explained by the supernatural, and it all kind of like fit in with human characteristics, right?
Yes. I mean, it's not,
there was no weird stuff, you know, it was all just kind of like, you know, taking just like ordinary people and then framing them in extraordinary circumstances, kind of like a laboratory experiment and turning the dials and see what happens. So that's kind of how all that got going. So I did that, and I got involved with my editor personally after the first book, and sold him a series of books. So that sort of then it became a series, and I don't know if my agent was so excited about that. I sort of. You know, like I tend to meddle in things and, you know, but that was good because I got a bunch of money. The good part was I got a bunch of money and I bought a house and we all went to Europe and hung out and it was cool. But then I had to write all these books.
That's it.
The downside was I had to write all these books.
The work.
And then at that point, the publishing business had started to get complicated. And so I had like a really dynamite editor for a couple of books. But then suddenly I hit this phase where every book I would change editors between books. So I don't know if this is interesting stuff to you guys or not, but I so it was unfun because the guy that I would deliver the manuscript to would not really be interested. He'd be buying his own books, and this would be somebody else's project. And then, you know, I mean, it changed every editor. It just got to be just horrible. You know, I mean, I didn't enjoy it even a little bit. And so where the music thing comes all back into this is, you know, back in the day when I was in college, I was a musician in addition to being an English major. So I sort of had played music all along and had played music intermittently in between the books. And so sort of my thing is as a creative guy, probably like you guys, is I've just got to have some outlet. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I can write, I can play music. It doesn't make any difference to me. You know, it's like, you know, what field is the crop growing up in right now? And the cool thing right now, which is really, including if you're a writer, is the whole thing, which I don't think we've come to grips with at all as a culture, is the just sort of the what the internet and digital disruption have done to everything. So, I mean, I can be my own recording studio. I can be my own publisher. I can be my own film studio. I can be my own TV studio. And you know, the downside of that is that there's just a tsunami of trash out there floating around. But there's a lot of really great stuff, and there's really no, you know, barrier to getting into the game if you're a creative person. You know, one thing I wonder about sometimes is, I mean, I really I really do not have any interest in much contemporary music. But I mean, back in the day when I was like in school, there were so many great bands, and there was such a great thing going on with the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers and Led Zeppelin, and just even the bands that I thought of that I used to think sucked, like Lynyrd Skynyrd, really were very good. And I think the barrier to entry and the level of expertise you had to have as a songwriter and a producer was so high that kind of anything that got out there was so freaking good. Even if it was even if it was Sonny and Cher, it was so well done. I was listening to a thing I watched a documentary about Linda Ronstadt, and her first song, like the way that they had envisioned producing it, different drum than the way it actually came out once the evil music business got a hold of it. And I'm sure it was the evil music business, but my God, it was just like, it had to be, 50 stories of more quality and product and production. Not that it wasn't, I'm really a roots music guy these days, so I'm not into that. I mean, that's not really what I'm going for. But it's like, it's hard to deny the value of, the value added nature of some of that stuff. So anyway.
Michael Rompe, you're my spirit animal, dude. I'm serious. Like, everything you've said is so profound. I feel like I can't finish a sentence right now. I swear, I could not agree with you more on every level, man. From the book publishing to the idea and what you just most recently were talking about. I do believe that, or I agree with you now that, anybody with a microphone and a computer and internet access can be a musician, and you can print your own books, and you can, that barrier. I said, man, this is the best conversation I've had in like forever. And because, again, typically, I mean, all three of us can agree on this, is that if we say this and just the general public, they will set us on fire, because and what I mean by that is, like with self-publishing, and Lord God, I'm not picking on these people, I promise. But there is something to say, and I've always agreed with it, that the traditional publishing or the music track, it you have to go through all it. One, it's a rite of passage. It is. I believe that, you have to enter into, fight, fumble, doubt, fear, that way that when you get to the end, the product is the best that it possibly can be. And you're now wearing that armor you need and have the wherewithal and the knowledge you need to continue to grow. Without those outside, without those people that are professionals around. And yes, like you said, like Linda Ronstadt, that, there is a chance that these, big, entities can change your whole song and, make it something else. But when you step away from the ego, you have to consider, like, well, did that make the song better? It might not be what you originally thought of. And it's the same thing with the book business. If you don't have somebody there from that industry that knows the rules and knows the business and knows how best to present your work, you have no frame of reference as an artist if your work is actually good. Of course, you're going to think it's genius because you're your only judge in the whole process of it, and so being like what you're saying is, I love the fact that we have the internet and stuff, that from the marketing aspect, like you've written it, now you can get it out there and get it in front of a whole bunch of new people, but it does kind of watered down the whiskey, as it was, just with the amount that's gushing out there. What I've seen time and time again is that and that with all that round, and again, I'm not being judgmental, I promise, but when you've got this cesspool, that's a very judgmental word, but of things that were not checked by anybody and people are just pumping it out there, when you have worked with a professional and your product comes out, I believe that it shines because of that. The onslaught of just, have, fair to middling material that's already out there. I've waited to have this conversation for like 20 years. Mike, that just means so much to me. I'm serious, man. I'm trying not to go full fanboy here. But I can distinctly remember, and I told you this, and I mean this, there are two novelists that when I read the first book, I went, I've got to go out and find everything that they've ever written. And it's you and Pat Conroy. I was sitting in a, and of course, I don't know what this says. I know exactly what it says about me. Sitting in my shrink's waiting room, and I was with iVampire. And I'm not the vampire, the whole lore thing. Of course, like you said, it's extremely alluring because you never grow old. You always be, you know, pretty and young, and you don't have to worry about disease and all that kind of stuff. But it had been really beat to death, you know, and it always had been. But what struck me with iVampire was that it reminded me of, like, iRobot, you know, there was already this, it removed it from the sauciness of it. And it already on the cover was like, this is a bite. I'd never seen anything like it. So, you know, I was sitting there and I was reading it, and distinctly remember how miserable the lead character was that later turned into the vampire that was totally on cocaine, and he had spilled some on the carpet, and he laid down and he was licking it off the carpet, and he thought, I got to change my life. And again, so it was one of those things that, when you see it, and then again, it's like, you know, here's my Oprah moment, but it's like, when you've had issues with that kind of stuff, you understand that desperation and how bad it's gotten, and how he sat up and said, you know, something's got to change, you know? And, then when he was introduced to the vampire culture and became one, I remember thinking, like, you know what, if I ever really got into that drug addiction, that'd be an awesome alternative. You know, that would definitely get you, but it's, again, it's just one example of your realism in the way you wrote. And then the parlay into something that did not. And I picked up on it as well. That's what I didn't like about most of the vampire stories. It's like, and now they're bats, and they're, you know, they're mist in the night, and you removed all of the tropes that every other book really hammered on. Also, what took me aback was that it was your novels are written with a deceptively simple brilliance. And I say this on every show, and now you go back and listen, Amadeo will tell you, I never flatter. I think flattery is just the sweetest way to lie to somebody. You'll pick up on it. The listeners will pick up on it. But the eloquence and the word economy and the succinctness in which you would write, when I found out that you were a journalist, I'm like, that's how he does it. That's how he's got that. He brought that same skill into the novel world, because, and I'm not hating on Anne Rice, but she will go for 7 chapters talking about the Rococo walls and what the chairs look like and what everybody was. And so it's like, you know, where's the dialogue? Let's get to that, you know, and you were completely dialogue and character driven. And so to see this main character who, and again, like this real neat kind of a marriage of a guy who's trying to beat addiction that then does it by drinking blood, you know, but to me, it's no one's ever done that before. You know, the fact that he found himself and what he was, you know, and the Illuminati, you know, component of it, that you took that word that even then was like, oh shit, was it? You made it something that was, you know, you had the good versus evil, and then you had the good ones that got together to make the world a better place. And you never saw that happen. You never saw. And in the course of the book, you saw the main character develop where when you typically have any other vampire story, they're not a vampire and then they are a vampire. That's the only growth you really see. Unless you, here I am going to kick on Anne Rice a little bit. You have Louis, who I never understood, was whining about, you know, I'm living forever. Just kill dead, you know, kill the evil people. Why are you quit moaning? You didn't have those weaknesses of plot line in it. You know, I'm telling you, man, I told you I loved your books, and I'm trying not to have spoiler alerts for everybody
else. You're too kind.
I'm absolutely honest, because again, I'll tell you, I'm one of those guys that if I didn't like it, you know, and somehow we met, I'm like, yeah, it's okay. But you know, I fell asleep halfway through and threw up. But when I read, I identify, and again, it's identified immediately with your characters, because there was also that internal yet not melodramatic constant battle within themselves on, you know, who am I, and, you know, who can I trust, and you know, where am I going in all of this, and what am I losing, what am I gaining? And I've never seen it before, and I've never seen it since done that way. And they've always stuck with me. When it's also the first book, I've seen tons of books that used it as a means to try, I guess, look smart, where they would have every chapter start with a line of poem, a poetry, but the poetry never really fit what it was. It was something that you read a million times. And I mean this, it was one of the first times that I saw the practical use of poetry in a way that just didn't connect to the chapter, but there was this seamless. It was a music to me. I remember telling one of my best friends, I was like, I wonder if he's a musician, because the way that you would write, the cadence of what you would pick, the way that the poetry and the excerpt would flow into the chapter was, to me, it felt very the way that you would write music, you know, the way that you wanted all of it to harmonize and not just be, you know, compliment one another, but the way that it actually rolled one into the next. And I bring that up again because in regards to poetry specifically, what drew you to that art form? And part two is, who are some of your favorite poets?
Oh, man. A hard question. Yeah, I don't know. I just always have really liked poetry a lot. Mm-hmm. And I can't write poetry. I don't know. I don't have it. You know, I can write a book, but I can't write a poem. You know, I'm just mm-hmm. too loquacious. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I think, you know, obviously I was a reporter and a journalist. And so every word has to count. You know, there can't be any, you know, and my late great wife, who was a wonderful editor both of fiction and of journalism, you know, she would write on my, you know, she'd write blah, blah, blah across pages, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. You know, I was starting to like let my research creep into the story. You know, you research how something or other works, and, you know, then you have to tell people about that. It's like, no, you don't have to tell them about that.
Right.
So, I mean, I think, I mean, the writing part of it is easy. The being inspired part is the hard part, because that sort of stuff just seeps into your bones when you read it, and it's mm-hmm. there, and it never goes away. And, you know, I guess it's, hopefully it pays homage to people who can really do that. Shakespeare, Eliot, Spencer, Donne, mm-hmm. Yeats.
Yeats. I got you. Either tomato.
It's not Yeats, it's Yeats. You know, slouching towards Bethlehem. I mean, I just love that stuff. But I don't, you know, I wonder, I mean, maybe you would know better than I about this. I mean, does that still resonate with people?
Yes.
I mean, I'm really concerned about the written word and about books. And, you know, I used to get paid every Thursday and I'd go to Borders Books. Mm. And there were a whole selection of novels that I hadn't read yet that I had to read so that I knew, you know, how E.M. Forster wrote, or this, that, or the other thing. And I don't really have a sense that, you know, the bookstores aren't there. I don't really feel like I need to read the new Tom Wolfe book, because Tom Wolfe's dead. But I mean, are there new Tom Wolfe books? You know, is there a new Bonfire of the Vanities? I mean, what's happening with literature right now? It concerns me.
Honestly, again, it's from the way I see it, is the concerns are absolutely valid. But in the last couple of years, there has been a legitimate like resurgence in what you're saying, and actually a starvation and hunger for exactly what you're talking about in the series. And within that series, because, you know, I study in a side gig, I study a lot about the trends and stuff. But the purchase of poetry and the purchase of novels, but novels that have an ongoing series has skyrocketed in the last, I think they now it's up to like the 2, 3, 5 years, because it's a backlash to all that garbage that came out. Sorry, not garbage. Self-published stuff that's out there that people have, you know, I tend to have a lot of faith in the readers, like true readers that have got into that and go, this is garbage. Where's the real stuff? You know, where's the stuff that's actually got those that are harmonic?
So what's the distribution channel? How do people find those books?
By and large, Barnes and Noble, you know, still thriving, you know, and when I go in there, they're packed, you know, and it didn't used to be that way. And when I go in there now, it's notable. Like it's almost like the crowds you see around Christmas. No joke. There's Amazon. I'm not ever bashing on them because I think if I do, my body would disappear and you'd never hear from me again. That makes it much more easy. But with COVID lifting up and people getting back out there, they love going to the actual bookstores. You know what I'm saying? And Ingram Sparks is a big distribution now that the small and middle presses too are making a huge comeback because they're able to be even more, I don't like this word at all, but like organic and you know, from that, people are starved to death for that depth and that connectivity and that elegance that was there before everything got soundbite, you know. When I was asked, what really got me back on getting you on this show was somebody had asked me about, you know, they were in the vampire books, and I immediately went, oh, because when they talk about like a vampire, but like, oh my, I was like, wait, no, it's called, you know, I Vampire. And then what that made me do is go back and read, and I've told it to five people. And again, I was like, if he disbelieves me, I'm going to have these people send me a letter to show you the humanity that's in your work and I know we're running out of time because I mean again I'm going to have
so you the, so I owe you the royalty checks.
No, you don't. No, this is so cool right now that I'm trying not to be like, oh my god, he's on my show. You know, it's
too nice.
But no, I'm serious. It's there's a resurgence and your work and your body of novels fits completely seamlessly back into what people want to read. And when people read something about vampires and then they find something that you've done, that it's his own complete different mythos and world building. The whole good versus evil. And then you use words like Illuminati and things that people are used to, but it's in a completely different way. I think I Vampire was what, 93, 90. It came out in the early 90s, right? Am I wrong?
I have no brain. I don't know.
Okay. Well,
I have no brain.
I disagree. And if you don't, then I want to know how you do what you do, because, you know, I would like to sometimes just pull this out and not worry about it. We are running out of time on this one. I cannot believe it just blinked past. This has been the best conversation.
I really appreciate the enthusiasm. I mean, it's a big boost in the arm. I remember my late stepfather, who was the editor of National Enquirer, he wrote a couple of books, and I can remember him saying that it would be all worthwhile if, you know, after he were gone, he'd know that somebody read one of his books and it meant something to him. And I guess I thought that was hopelessly corny, but I really don't anymore. I think that that's a cool thing. But, you know, you put a ton of work into something and, you know, it's kind of in the door, out the door, and it hangs around. I mean, it's very meaningful.
And your books are still in bookstores. You know what I'm saying? It's, you know, that's another big deal, is how long the books have been out. Typically, the life expectancy of the average book on the shelf is maybe 5 years before it's out of print. And
it's scary.
They're all, you know, it shouldn't be to you. I mean, the books can sometimes be. But the fact, again, I'm trying to cram in all the great parts of it, is that you in each book bring back these huge figures in music and literature that have, you know, that people saved in part of the Illuminati to keep and maintain that genius, you know. And it's never hokey. It's never, you know, you absolutely don't get sticky. And, you know, and again, I always go back to the Louis, you don't have a character that's like, it sucks to be young forever, I can't do this, oh my god. You know, it's like, where's the vampire Prozac and how do we get it some to him, you know?
I want to thank you so much for the kind words. And this has been very gratifying for me. It's cool to know that there are people reading the books who are out there who are as enthusiastic as you are. And, you know, you put a lot of your soul into those. And it's nice to know that people recognize that.
Both Cliff and I want to say thank you for spending your time with us. We want to say thank you to Michael Romke for a fantastic conversation. You can find Michael at michaelromke.com. You can find Cliff Brooks at cliffbrooks.com or at southerncollectiveexperience.com. You can find myself at michaelomedy.com, worldpoetrymagazine.com, and worldpoetryopenmic.com. Until next time, remember to be yourself. The world needs your authenticity. Do the hard work and conquer your obstacles creatively. Remember to follow your heart, for it's easy to lose your head in this business of music and poetry.